Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Jason Riley, a member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and author of Let Them In, The Case for Open Borders, and Please Stop Helping Us, How Liberals Make It Harder for Blacks to Succeed. His topic will be Federal Spending's Impact on Low-Income Americans. This program, co-sponsored by the Hyder College of Business's Institute of Economic Inquiry at Creighton University, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday morning, October 14, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Jason Riley is an American journalist and a member of the Wall Street Journal editorial board. He is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and frequently appears at the Journal Editorial Report, as a guest on several television news programs, and on C-SPAN. Riley was born in Buffalo, New York, and earned a bachelor's degree in English from the State University of New York at Buffalo. His first jobs in journalism were for the Buffalo News and USA Today. He joined the Wall Street Journal in 1994 as a copy reader on the National News Desk in New York. In April 1996, he was named to the newly created position of Editorial Interactive Editor and joined the editorial board in 2005. In 2008, he wrote Let Them In, The Case for Open Borders, which he promoted on the Colbert Report and other venues. In 2014, Riley published Please Stop Helping Us, How Liberals Make It Harder for Blacks to Succeed. The book was praised by Thomas Sowell of the National Review, who wrote, quote, "Pick up a copy and open pages at random to see how the author annihilates nonsense," unquote. According to Salon magazine, quote, "The American left should start paying attention to the Wall Street Journal's Jason Riley. His name is on the rise." Here now to speak on the topic, Federal Spending's Impact on Low-Income Americans, is Jason Riley.
Thank you for that introduction, Professor. Thank you, Dean. I also want to thank Creighton University and the Institute for Economic Inquiry for the invitation to speak here this morning. As I was telling a group of students I met with last night, my first book was about immigration. My second book was about race. So I obviously pick the easy subjects, the ones that bring us together as a country and unite us. Makes me very popular on social media and the cable news channels. But today I wanted to talk about something that I think most people do agree on, which is that despite a half century of concerted efforts by civil rights leaders and politicians to help the black underclass, the black underclass is in pretty bad shape. What we're trying isn't working very well. Now, the agreement pretty much ends there, but it is a start. So let's begin with the good news. This year marks the 50th anniversary of what may be Martin Luther King's most significant accomplishment, the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Last year, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which outlawed discrimination based on race and gender and religion and gave blacks access to jobs and schools and public facilities. But access to the voting booth, access to the ballot, was still a challenge for blacks, particularly in the South. President Lincoln said, "We're a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, but that's only true if all the people can register and vote." The ability to vote is, of course, what protects all the other freedoms we enjoy in this country, because it's how we hold our politicians and elected officials responsible for the decisions that they make. So after the Civil Rights Act passed, Dr. King pressed for a Voting Rights Act, too. And 50 years ago this summer, President Johnson signed it into law. And it's been a remarkable success. Just to give you a sense of how successful it's been, in 1964, the year before it passed, only 7% of blacks in the state of Mississippi were registered to vote. That was the lowest percentage of anywhere in the South. But by 1966, just 1 year after the Voting Rights Act passed, the black voter registration rate in Mississippi had climbed to 60%. the highest in the South. And Mississippi was not alone. And Georgia went from 19% to 51% over the same period. In fact, in every southern state, the gains were striking. Today, black voter registration in the South is higher than it is in other parts of the country. And of course, most blacks still live in the U.S. South. And in 2012, the last presidential election year, the percentage of blacks who voted was actually higher than the percentage of whites who voted for the first time in U.S. history. That's how significant the Voting Rights Act has been. Along with the Civil Rights Act, it's represented the culmination of a modern-day civil rights movement. And what I wanted to talk about for a few minutes this morning is what has happened in the wake of these civil rights victories, of these political victories that were supposed to lead to greater economic prosperity for the black poor. What has risen from the ruins of Jim Crow in terms of policies aimed at blacks in general and the black underclass in particular? Where has there been progress? Where has there been retrogression? What's working? What's not working? And how much of what's not working can be blamed on residual racism? I think it's a good time to ask those questions because this year also marks the 50th anniversary of the Great Society programs that were supposed to help eliminate poverty and reduce racial inequality in America. Just before this signing the Voting Rights Act into law, Lyndon Johnson gave a famous speech at Howard University, the historically black college in Washington, D.C., where he talked about what the government should do next on behalf of blacks. This was merely the end of the beginning, he said. And then he said, "That beginning is freedom, and the barriers to that freedom are tumbling down. Freedom is the right to share fully and equally in American society, to vote, to hold a job, to enter a public place." But freedom is not enough, he added. You do not take a person who for years has been hobbled by chains and liberate him, bring him up to the starting line of a race, and then say, you're free to compete with all the others, and then still believe you've been completely fair to that person. Johnson said that the next and more profound stage of the battle for civil rights was not just equality as a right and a theory, but equality as a fact and equality as a result. Johnson was moving the goalpost. He was saying that equal opportunity isn't enough. He wanted the government to ensure equal outcomes. But what if Johnson was mistaken? What if there are limits to what the government can do beyond removing barriers to freedom? What if the best that we can hope for from our elected officials are policies that promote a level playing field for all? What if public policymakers risk creating more problems and barriers to progress when the focus becomes equal outcomes? I think there are limits, even when the policies are well-intentioned. And I think the past half century provides plenty of evidence of this. For more than 50 years, the political left has pushed for more government assistance for blacks through racial preferences, forced integration, expanded welfare entitlements, and so forth. Black leaders have urged racial solidarity and prioritized the pursuit of political power for blacks. Between 1970 and 2010, the number of black elected officials grew from fewer than 1,500 to more than 10,000, including, of course, a black president. But how has that helped the black underclass? In 2013, Mississippi had more black elected officials than any other state in the country. Yet it continues to have one of the highest black poverty rates in the country. Over the past half century, the U.S. has spent some $20 trillion after inflation on anti-poverty programs alone. What do we have to show for it? The official poverty rate in 2012 was higher than it was in 1965. And the black-white poverty gap has widened over the past decade. The racial disparity in incarceration rates is also larger than it was in the 1960s. Black unemployment, on average, has been twice as high as white unemployment for 5 decades. Yes, gains have been made. On balance, blacks are certainly better off than they were in 1965. But the track record regarding the black poor is appalling. It's clear that government programs aren't the solution to many of the problems that they face. The Great Society programs may be well-intentioned, but they aren't getting the job done. And the question is why? I think blacks ultimately have to help themselves. They have to develop the same attitudes and habits and behaviors that other groups developed in order to rise in America. And to the extent that a government policy, however well-intentioned, interferes with that essential self-development, it does more harm than good. Open-ended welfare benefits do not help people develop a work ethic, which is ultimately what they must develop to rise out of poverty. Increasing the minimum wage to $15 an hour, as some are calling for, will increase the cost of hiring a younger, less experienced worker, many of whom are black. So fewer blacks will wind up getting that first job and the experience that comes with it. Soft-on-crime laws make ghettos more dangerous for the mostly law-abiding residents who live there, and they make life easier for the criminals who primarily prey on poor blacks, and so on. Yet all of these policies continue to be pushed in the name of helping blacks. The promoters of such policies don't seem very interested in reevaluating what has been tried. It's also important to note the progress that was occurring among blacks prior to the implementation of many of these programs designed to help them. Programs that have often received all the credit for any progress that we have seen. For example, between 1940 and 1960, black poverty in the U.S. fell by 40 percentage points. That's before the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act were passed. That was during Jim Crow. That was during a period of open, rampant, and legal racial discrimination in this country. A 40 percentage point drop in black poverty. Now, poverty continued to fall after the Great Society programs were implemented in the 1960s, but at a much slower rate. At best, the Great Society continued a trend already in place. Yet these programs are often given all the credit for reductions in black poverty. The reality is that no Great Society has ever come close to matching the reduction in black poverty that we saw prior to the Great Society. No Great Society program has ever come close to matching what blacks were doing on their own before the government decided to step in and help. The notion that black people must help themselves is not based on some right-wing extremist ideology. It's based on experience. History shows that there simply is no substitute for a group's self-development. Government programs cannot save us, and an over-dependence on them can do us great harm. Affirmative action, racial preferences, are another example of a program that gets more credit than it deserves. In this case, credit for increasing the size of the black middle class. But what does the record show? The record shows that between 1930 and 1970, the percentage of black white-collar workers in this country quadrupled. That's during a period before affirmative action policies were put in place. That's during a period when you could put a sign in your window that said, "We don't hire blacks." Yet in the face of these obstacles, blacks were entering the skilled professions at unprecedented rates. Yes, blacks continued to enter the white-collar professions in the wake of racial preferences. But again, this simply continued an existing trend. There was a substantial black middle class already in place by the end of the 1960s. It has continued to grow since then, but at a much slower pace. And as with black poverty reduction, no affirmative action program has ever come close to matching what blacks were doing on their own prior to the implementation of the program. Moreover, racial preferences have not helped the poor, as proponents promised. Instead, they have worked mostly to help already well-off blacks become better off. There have been case studies of this in places like Atlanta, for example, where in the 1970s and 80s, under black mayors like Maynard Jackson and Andrew Young, the city implemented racial preference policies for hiring black city workers and black contractors. What happened? Well, the number of successful black businesses increased rapidly. But the average income blacks were left behind, and the black poor lost ground. And that's been the story of the black poor, not only in places like Atlanta, but nationwide. In the era of affirmative action, the black underclass has lost ground both in absolute terms and relative to the white underclass. In the 1970s and 80s, and even into the 1990s, the first full decades of affirmative action policies, the poorest 20% of blacks saw their incomes decline at more than double the rate of comparable whites. Again, the empirical data show that in an era of racial preferences and quotas and set-asides put in place to help the black poor, that subset has regressed. Affirmative action in higher education was also supposed to increase the ranks of black professionals. But after California banned racial preferences in college admissions, what happened? What happened is that black graduation rates in the University of California system rose by a lot. Instead of funneling black kids into schools where they were overmatched but admitted anyways for diversity reasons, black students started doing what white students and Asian students do. They attended schools that better matched their skill level. And as a result, more of them graduated. A lot more. Black graduation rates at the University of California system increased by more than 50% after racial preferences were ended, including in the more difficult fields of math, and science, and engineering. Again, by more than 50%. In other words, racial preferences, which were sold as a way to increase the size of the black middle class, had resulted in fewer black doctors and lawyers and engineers than we would have had in the absence of these policies. These policies are not helping. They are harming. But I would also argue that there's a large cultural component to the racial disparities we see today, whether we're talking about employment, education, incarceration, income, or other measures. The problem is that it's become almost taboo to talk about black cultural problems, antisocial behavior, attitudes towards work, school, parenting, and so forth. Black kids teasing one another for acting white. I've often told the story about a trip back home to Buffalo, New York, where I was born and raised. This was more than 20 years ago. I was visiting my older sister shortly after I'd begun working at the Wall Street Journal. And I was chatting with her daughter, my niece, who was maybe in the second grade at the time. I was asking her about school, her favorite subjects, that sort of thing, when she stopped me in the middle of a sentence. She said, "Uncle Jason, why you talk white?" She turned to her little friend sitting next to her and said, "Don't my uncle sound white? Why are you trying to sound so smart?" Now, she was just teasing, of course, and I smiled and they enjoyed a little laugh at my expense. But what she said really stayed with me. I couldn't help thinking, here were two young black girls, 7 or 8 years old, already linking speech patterns to race and intelligence. They already had a rather sophisticated awareness that as blacks, white-sounding speech was not only to be avoided in their own speech, but mocked in the speech of other blacks. Now, I shouldn't have been too surprised by this, and I wasn't. My siblings, along with countless other black friends and relatives, teased me the same way when I was growing up. And other black professionals, from the president and first lady on down, have told similar stories. What I had forgotten is just how early these attitudes take hold, how soon this counterproductive thinking and behavior can begin. New York City, where I'm based, has the largest school system in America. And 80% of black kids in New York City schools are performing below grade level. 80%. And a big part of the problem is a black subculture that rejects attitudes and behaviors conducive to academic success. Black kids read half as many books and watch twice as much television as their white counterparts, for example. In other words, a big part of the problem is a culture that produces little black girls and boys who are already worried about acting and sounding white by the time they are in the second grade. Another big part of the problem is a reluctance to speak honestly about these cultural shortcomings. Many whites feel being called racist, and many black leaders have a vested interest in blaming black problems primarily on white racism. So that is the narrative they push, regardless of the reality. Racism has become an all-purpose explanation for bad black outcomes, be they social or economic. If you disagree and are white, you're a bigot. If you disagree and are black, you're a sellout. Too often, this is the level of name of discourse. Schoolyard name-calling, as the dean was referencing earlier. Even President Obama has been subjected to this treatment when he broaches the topic of black cultural shortcomings. On several occasions, he has spoken to black audiences, for example, about absent black fathers. When he spoke at Morehouse College in Atlanta a couple years ago, he said, "I was raised by a heroic single mother and wonderful grandparents who made incredible sacrifices for me. But I still wish I had a father who was not only present but involved. And so my whole life, I've tried to be for Michelle and my girls what my father wasn't for my mother and me. I've tried to be a better father, a better husband, a better man." Obama told the black men in those audience, he told the black men in the audience to be a good role model for other less fortunate black men. He said, "The brothers who have been left behind, who haven't had the same opportunities we've had, they need to learn from us. We need to be in the barbershops with them, at church with them, helping to pull them up, exposing them to new opportunities. We have to teach them what it means to be a man," said the president. Now, that might sound like common sense to you and me. In fact, there may be some people in this room who wish this is all Obama would ever talk about. But Obama gets slammed by liberals when he says things like this in public. And black liberals in particular go after him because he's seen as criticizing black culture, condescending to blacks, being an elitist. Those are the accusations he gets thrown at him. Most significantly, he's accused of letting whites off the hook when he talks like this, which is a big no-no on the black left. You don't do that. But the facts are on Obama's side. For decades, studies have shown that the likelihood of teen pregnancy, drug abuse, dropping out of school, and many other bad social outcomes increases dramatically when fathers aren't around. One of the most comprehensive studies ever done about this concluded that black boys without a father were 68% more likely to be incarcerated as those with a father. The study said that overall, the most critical factor affecting the prospect that a male youth will encounter the criminal justice system is the presence of a father in the home. All other factors, including family income, are much less important. One social scientist put it this way: if crime is to a significant degree caused by weak character, if weak character is more likely among children of unmarried mothers, if there are no fathers who will help raise their children, acquire jobs, protect their neighborhoods, if boys become young men with no preparation for work, if school achievement is regarded as a sign of having sold out, if all these things are true, then the chances of reducing the crime rate among low-income blacks anytime soon is slim. This is what we see playing out in Baltimore, in St. Louis, in Chicago, in the Bronx today. But you're not supposed to say that. It's politically incorrect. Try to bring up black culture in a debate over criminal behavior today. You will have your head handed to you. Try bringing up the breakdown of the black family in a debate about crime. In fact, we don't even talk about black crime anymore. We talk about black incarceration rates, as if incarceration rates have no relation at all to black behavior. We talk about police shootings of black men as a measure of whether America values black lives or whether cops value black lives. We've had mobs of people all over the country pretending that there is an epidemic of cops shooting blacks. And the media has played right along. This is nonsense. Police are involved in approximately 2% of black shooting deaths in this country each year. One economist has calculated that a cop is about 6 times as likely to be shot by someone black as the opposite scenario. In March of this year, 4 cops were killed over a 7-day period. All of them were black. How many of you were even aware of that? Do you know their names? Where was the wall-to-wall media coverage? Where were the outraged protesters? Where were the civil rights leaders? Where was the White House press conference? Do those black lives matter? Blacks are about 13% of the population in this country, but commit more than half of all murders. Roughly 7,000 blacks are murdered each year in America, and 90% of them are killed by other blacks. The question isn't whether cops value black lives or America values black lives. Isn't the more relevant question whether the young black men doing all of this killing value black lives? Are we supposed to hold whites to a higher standard than blacks hold each other? I think a previous generation of civil rights leaders would have laughed at that notion. Homicide is the leading cause of death for young black men in the U.S., the leading cause of death. And it is not because cops are shooting them. Bad cops should be punished to the full extent of the law. And they should certainly be held to a high standard for violating the public trust. But if you believe that black lives matter, if you want to reduce the black body count, as a practical matter, should your focus be on the 2% of black shooting deaths that involve cops or the 98% that don't? The violence that is so prevalent in these neighborhoods has enormous economic consequences. The common assumption, the one pushed regularly in the media, is that poverty causes crime. But the truth is closer to the opposite. Businesses flee crime-ridden neighborhoods. Jobs follow. Property values fall. One reason that blacks were progressing at a much faster rate in the first half of the 20th century is that black communities were much less violent, despite being much poorer. The violence so prevalent today dates to the policy interventions of the 1960s, when coddling criminals became fashionable among judges and politicians and academics, and the government mistakenly believed that a welfare check could replace a father in the home. Before 1960, 2 out of 3 black children were raised in 2-parent families in this country. 2/3. Today, more than 70% are not. And in many of our inner cities, it's as high as 80 or 90%. Before 1960, homicide rates in the U.S., including among blacks, had been falling significantly. In fact, the murder rate in 1960 was less than half of what it had been just 25 years earlier. Blacks obviously faced much more racism back then, but black communities were also much safer and so more conducive to social and economic progress. Let me close by noting that this concept of self-help and self-development that I think is essential to black advancement is something that black leaders understood all too well. And at a time, back at a time when blacks faced infinitely more obstacles than they face with a twice-elected black man in the Oval Office. Frederick Douglass, a former slave, said in 1865 that everybody had asked him and the other abolitionists what to do with the Negro. He said, "I've had but one answer from the beginning, do nothing with us. If the apples will not remain on the tree of their own strength, let them fall. And if the Negro cannot stand on his own legs, let him fall also. All I ask is give him a chance to stand on his own legs." Douglass was essentially saying, give blacks equal opportunity and then leave us alone. Booker T. Washington, another former slave, echoed that sentiment. He said that it is important and right that all privileges of the law be ours, but it is vastly more important that we be prepared for the exercise of these privileges. Douglass and Washington didn't play down the need for the government to secure equal rights for blacks. And both were optimistic that that day would one day come, though neither man lived to see it. But both men also understood the limits of government benevolence. Blacks would have to ready themselves to meet the far bigger challenge of being in a position to take advantage of opportunities once equal rights had been secured. The history of 1960s liberal social policies is largely a history of ignoring this wisdom. The Obama presidency is more evidence that blacks have progressed politically. But if the rise of other racial and ethnic groups is any indication, black social and economic problems are less about politics than they are about culture. A black man in the White House is all well and good, but he can't substitute for one in the home. On that happy note, I will stop and take any questions if you have them. Thank you.
A member of the audience raised a question concerning the issue of government monetary assistance, whether we're doing enough, and whether it would help to raise the levels of welfare through higher taxes.
Well, haven't we tried this? I mean, again, since the 1960s, as I mentioned, something like $20 trillion in inflation-adjusted government spending on anti-poverty programs. This notion that we're not spending enough, I just don't think the track record supports that more spending in the ways that we're spending is the way to go. Again, the national poverty rate in 1966 was lower than it was in 2012 after all of this spending. I don't think the problem is that we're not throwing enough resources at the poor. What this is more of is wealth redistribution, wealth transfers. We've tried this. My response would be to just look at the track record, and what does it show?
Yeah. You mentioned the you talked about the cultural attitude that prevails now that I presume didn't, I don't think it, it was probably in existence, the sort of not to act too white kind of thing, is probably existed for a very long time, but wasn't prevalent until the 60s. Is that about correct?
It was not embraced the way it was, not only by so many blacks, but by the surrounding white culture that began to romanticize it.
Dominates now.
And it is, yeah, it was behavior, there were attitudes and behaviors that were roundly condemned at one point. They are celebrated by contrast today. And that is a hard, you know, the telling a kid to pull up his pants or speak correctly is, those are fighting words.
I'm trying to figure out what underpins that and what makes it so unassailable now. In you know, it sort of reminds me of the sort of the Palestinian conflict in the West Bank, where the attitude is blame Israel for everything, and it's unassailable. You can't change that.
Yeah.
Why is that so now that as soon as you speak out, you get condemned?
I think it's of a piece with the rise in multiculturalism, this relativism. Of cultures as a mindset. A lot of it, no offense intended, comes out of the academy. we've seen the rise of this sort of thinking that the behaviors, the attitudes, customs of other cultures cannot be looked down upon. They cannot be criticized, or only gently so, because all of these cultures are valid.
Despite
all
history,
will equally lead to the same outcomes, and so it's this mindset that I think has led to a reluctance to condemn or criticize behaviors that we used to do regularly.
How do you address it and expose it and defeat it? That's what I'm getting at. Is how do you win?
Well, I think as I said. In terms of who the you is, I mean, I don't know that the government has much of a role to play in doing this. This is something that I think the black community has to come together and do on its own, as other cultures have done. What's really interesting is if you look back at why I'm optimistic is, as you started out by noting, this was not always the case, even in black America. This was not always the case. But what history also shows, so in that sense, it's not about reinventing the wheel. It's about getting back to the way things used to be. But what history also shows is that other groups exhibited similar behaviors at different periods of time and grew out of them. So it is possible to evolve as a culture. And America's immigrant history is full of examples of this. Certain groups bringing certain behaviors here, and after a few generations, rising in part by leaving those behaviors behind. And so I am optimistic that things can change. I don't think the dominant culture blessing such attitudes or dismissing them as or romanticizing them helps. And you certainly have a lot of that going on. I think they need to be roundly condemned, but I don't think it's something that can't be reversed over time.
A question was asked concerning a 2013 documentary dealing with black self-sufficiency called The Lessons of Haiti, dealing with a small suburb of Durham, North Carolina, referred to in the early 1900s as the Black Wall Street. In the film, it shows that the white administration built an interstate system through Haiti, causing its destruction. An audience member asked why Mr. Riley hadn't mentioned this in his talk.
Okay, I don't think I have ignored that period. I think just the opposite, that it's the period I'm trying to draw attention to, that there is a period of black history when we saw much faster socioeconomic progress than what we've seen in the wake of the Great Society programs that were designed to help blacks. I think that's a neglected period of study. What was going on in black America after the Civil War, through Reconstruction, and through the Jim Crow era, tremendous gains were being made. The rate at which blacks were leaving poverty, entering the white-collar professions, and so forth. Part of this had to do with the migration out of the South. You know, doing the same job in Detroit versus Mobile, Alabama, is going to raise your wages automatically, and more blacks were moving to the North. The rate at which they were increasing their years of education, both in absolute terms and relative to whites, was also quite remarkable during this period. And I point to this period because it was a period when open and rampant racism existed in the country. Yet it was unable to stop this progress. And so when people today say that, black 12th graders are reading at the level of white 8th graders because of the legacy of slavery, I balk. It does not make logical sense to me. The other thing that blacks had going for them in the first half of the 20th century was a leadership that had the attitude that we must succeed as a people, notwithstanding racism. The attitude of that leadership's successors today is blacks cannot succeed until racism has been vanquished from America. And so they basically spend their time scouring the country for signs of Confederate flags or use of the N-word. And then going, oops, see, look, that explains all the kids shooting each other in Chicago. That explains the test score gap. That explains the unemployment rate. They are, and they're doing that, I think, out of a search for relevance. If the civil rights victories have been fought and won, and if barriers to black progress have next to nothing to do with any residual racism out there, Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson are out of a job. They are irrelevant. And so I think what you see in the civil rights, what I call the civil rights industry today, is a search for relevance, this desperation to keep white racism front and center in the national conversation as an all-purpose explanation for racial inequality that we see. Yeah.
A question was asked about black youth considering it uncool to, quote, act white. What part of the history of the late 20th century contributes most to that attitude? Was it the hip-hop culture?
The hip-hop culture probably reflects it more than anything, and certainly helps perpetuate it. But I think it predates that. I think it really dates to the 60s and the breakdown of the black family. It's very interesting that just to give you an example of the retrogression that has occurred on the education front. I'll give you two historical examples, which have always struck me as if you look at what blacks did coming out of slavery to increase their education levels, it is a remarkable history of education attainment. You're talking about a time period a few years away from when it was illegal to teach a slave to read and write in many states. Within a generation, most blacks were literate. I mean, it was just a remarkable human achievement. You're talking about a period when a black person caught with a book could be whipped or sometimes put to death. The things that blacks went through to get an education. And you fast forward 100 years, and a kid who wants to go to school is accused of acting white. It breaks your heart, the level of ignorance going on there. But progress... in New York City, to use another New York example, there are three, there are more than three, but the three top selective public high schools. You need tests to get in. You have to, they admit students based on test scores. So it's a mostly objective way of admitting students. If you go back and look at their records in the 1930s and 40s, a higher percentage of blacks were matriculating there then than are today. Yet, you bring this to the attention of some commentators and academics, and they'll say, well, that's racism. Because they say that's racism for everything. But again, how did the legacy of slavery skip a generation and then reassert itself in the 21st century? I mean, what was going on in the 1930s and 40s that led to these better academic outcomes in terms of admittance to these schools? And these schools today are dominated by Asian students, in fact, many of whom are poorer than their black and white classmates at the same schools, which speaks to this poverty argument as an explanation for why more blacks aren't in the schools. The Asian example also speaks to this notion that political power is the best vehicle for advancing a group socioeconomically. If you look at which groups are hitting out of the park today, both in terms of academic achievement, in terms of income, in terms of representation in the professional classes, it's Asian Americans. How much political power do Asian Americans have? So this notion that one necessarily leads to another, I think, was a big mistake of the civil rights movement back in the 1960s when they decided to focus on political empowerment, not education, economics. Yes.
Someone asked what we should do to increase black self-sufficiency.
Well, to the book's title, I think it's more about what we need to stop doing. In terms of economic remedies, I would stop raising minimum wage that prices less skilled, less experienced people out of work, many of whom happen to be black. And it's, I think it's a huge deal. The minimum wage is sold by proponents as an anti-poverty measure. But most poor people in America already make more than minimum wage. Most of the poor people who are working already make more than the minimum wage. And most of the people who make the minimum wage aren't poor. If you look at most poor households, the common factor is not workers who are making too little. It's no workers. What they need are jobs, not a raise. And to the extent that you lift the wage floor, you make it more difficult for them to find jobs because you make them more expensive to hire. Minimum wage hikes get sold in the name of helping the poor, but they're doing no such thing. And I think they are a huge factor, not just in terms of bringing in more income by allowing more people to find work, but also in terms of the experience young people get with that first job and how they can take that experience and start climbing the economic ladder. If they can't get that first job, there's a lot of lost human capital there. So I think in the business arena, that would be a place to fight for the right policy. But I'd also point to things like occupational licensing requirements, where sort of barriers to entry in certain fields. You want to go start a hair braiding salon, or you want to start a taxi company, but the barrier to entry is huge. so you can't start your business. In New York, you have the cab industry with a lot of political power. Medallions to start your own cab company are very expensive. Alongside that, you have a problem with cabs not wanting to go into high-crime black neighborhoods. There are people who live in high-crime black neighborhoods who would start their own cab company and service those people, but they can't because it's so expensive to get a medallion. So, again, something like occupational licensing is a barrier, I think. So there are set examples. On a more fundamental level, it's education. Kids trapped in poor schools with bad teachers, not having access to better schools. Opponents of school choice are doing blacks great harm, I think, when they keep them trapped in these schools. We know how to educate these kids. There are plenty of examples of such schools educating high-risk kids, but that model cannot expand at the rate to meet the demand because of opposition from teachers unions and others who see public education as primarily a jobs program for adults in this country. And what is happening with the kids is a secondary concern. A failing school stays open because it's still providing jobs, regardless of whether anyone is learning in that school. So there are a number of areas, I think, where a lot of good could be done, but a lot of it just is good could be done if the government would simply stop doing things that are harmful.
Yes. Jason, thanks for being here in Omaha at Creighton University. Excellent presentation. Your facts and data are compelling. The information you gave is very strong. The failure of the Great Society seems also unmistakable based upon what you're saying. It all boiled down to this, though, for me, from your presentation, the absence of the father in the family. Probably true in the black community, the white community, and Latino community as well, I assume. My question is, has there been social studies that have been done which can change that fact? Things that you know about as terms of solutions to that problem, because it seems that that would change things.
I'm not aware of social science studies that show a group reversing the trend. I think we see ups and downs. It slows, it accelerates. Someone mentioned Robert Putnam earlier. I think in his most recent book, he's seen a trend among higher marriage rates among whites. So it had been trending down, and it has started to reverse itself. So you look at things like that, and you're hopeful that it's not irreversible. I mean, but in terms of a big U-turn or something going like that in a short period of time, no, I haven't. I haven't come across that. I'm not sure. I'm not sure that that's been demonstrated so far as I know.
Would you have the government give people money so they cohabitate? If the problem is an absent father, how about subsidizing the father staying? In other words, your argument is by and large that the government programs have not succeeded, and the lesson you're saying is we need less government programs. I'm wondering if someone would reply, since you were talking about the absence of a father, that we have some type of government program where we would give people money if the father would stay married or stay in home. I mean, I can hear that program starting already.
Yeah. I I'm hesitant because it's another form of social engineering. And we're not really good at that.
Okay. You had a quotation from Douglass, I believe, where you said a part of it was that at least we have to be willing for the apple to drop from the tree.
Yes, I think he was his point was that equal opportunity in terms of what the government in terms of government policy.
Right. So the
he's not talking about the church should be doing or other community groups. He's talking about the government.
So in terms of government policy. Yeah. Not only should corporations be allowed to fail, but people too.
I wouldn't have a problem with that. I mean, I wouldn't argue for eliminating the social safety net. I think that we're a very compassionate society, and that's evidence of that. And the safety net, I think, has done. Obviously, a lot of good people come on hard times. They receive government assistance for a period. Hopefully, things get better, and they go back to their normal life. And I like having that there. And I think most Americans do. The problem are the incentives that have been put in place. So that social safety net is transient for the vast majority of Americans. But for some groups, it has become a lure and a trap. Generation after generation after generation, and that is the problem. I think in terms of the black underclass.
Thank you, and join me in thanking Mr. Jason Bobby.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Jason Riley, a member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and author of Let Them In, The Case for Open Borders, and Please Stop Helping Us, How Liberals Make It Harder for Blacks to Succeed. His topic was Federal Spending's Impact on Low-Income Americans. This program, co-sponsored by the Hyder College of Business's Institute of Economic Inquiry at Creighton University, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday morning, October 14, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.